It's a bit like seeking death by chasing the wind.
What do you mean? I'm not seeking death, Nelly.
It isn't your fault,
she mutters and scratches her neck with the knife blade.
I don't blame you.
She takes a few steps back and the shadows close around her pale face, painting big black holes where her eyes should be and drawing dark shapes across her neck.
But you'll see what mortality looks like, Eric, she says, and turns towards the stairs.
Don't do anything silly now, Eric calls to her. She stops and turns round. Sweat has run down her cheeks, and her makeup has almost come off now.
I really can't accept that you're going to carry on thinking about her,
Nelly says in a steady voice.
If you are going to think about her, then it should be a face without eyes and lips.
No, Nelly, Eric shouts, watching her disappear up the narrow staircase. He sinks down onto the floor, spits out the half-dissolved pill in his hand, and puts the loose remains in one pocket of his jeans. Chapter 128. Margot knows it's pretty unlikely that Nelly Brunt is either at her home in Brumma or at work at the Karolinska. Even so, she can't help feeling a deep anxiety in her body as she sits in her car further down the road and watches the National Task Force spreading out around the white modernist villa in Brumma. If she disregards the black-clad and heavily armed police officers, the entire area is dreamily peaceful, like one of many childhood evenings. Margot is following the operation on the radio, and the tension inside her is almost unbearable. She can't help imagining the silence being shattered by screams and discharged weapons. Her radio crackles as the head of the operation, Roger Storm, reports directly to her.
She's not here, he says.
Have they looked everywhere? She asks. Basement, attic, garden.
She's not here.
And her husband?
Sitting watching the diving on television.
What does he say?
I got straight to the point, but he says he's sure Nelly isn't involved. They've read all about Eric, and he says Nelly is just as shocked as him.
Okay, I don't give a shit about that right now, as long as he can tell us wherever the fuck she is,
Margot says, looking over towards the house.
They haven't got anywhere else. He's got no idea, Roger replies.
Is the response team finished?
They're on their way out.
Then I'm coming in, Margot says, and opens the car door.
The moment she stands up, she feels a dull ache at the small of her back. She realizes immediately what it means, but still carries on, and slowly makes her way up to the wide-open front door.
I'll give birth when I'm done with this case, she tells the officer standing at the door.
The hall is large, but cozy and welcoming. A Karl Larsson painting hangs opposite the door. The response unit are on their way out, helmets in hand, their automatic rifles swinging from their straps. In the gloom of the living room, a rather plump man is sitting in an armchair. He's loosened his tie and undone his top button, and there's a microwaved meal on a tray on the coffee table. He looks shocked, keeps rubbing his thighs and looking in bewilderment at the police officer who is talking to him.
It's a big house, he's explaining. It's enough for us, and in the winter we usually go to the Caribbean and your extended family.
Don't they have houses? Margot interrupts.
I'm the only one who lives in Sweden, he replies.
But if your wife was to borrow a house to go to, where would that be?
I'm sorry, I've got no idea.
Margot leaves him and heads upstairs, looks round, then goes into a bedroom and takes out her phone.
Nelly Brunt isn't at home, and she isn't at the Karolinska, she says as soon as Yuna answers.
Does she have any connection with any other properties?
Yuna Lina asks.
We've checked all the registries, Margot replies, gasping as the next contraction hits.
They don't own any other houses. They've got no summer cottage, no land. Where did she live before?
Margot takes out the printout of information she requested the moment she last spoke to Yuna.
According to the population registry, she lived at Schuldinger Rectory until 10 years ago. Then there's a gap of 4 years before she shows up here.
She lived with Rocky Schirklund in his rectory, Yuna says.
We've got people there, but these days it's sheltered housing for...
I know.
Obviously, she could have rented a flat, second or third hand.
In the diary, there are references to a farm in Ruslagen, Yuna says.
There's no farm, nothing she's got any connection to. Her family has never owned any land, and she's the last of her line.
But Rocky escaped from her and stole a car in Finster.
We don't know how far he walked on foot first.
There must be 1,000 farms around Nortelje,
Margot interrupts.
Check all her paperwork. I mean, if she's renting a farm from someone else, she may have paid electricity bills that don't have her name on them. Things like that.
We should be getting a decision about an official search warrant in a couple of hours.
Start looking and carry on until someone stops you, he says.
Okay, where do I begin?
If you think the husband's telling the truth, you need to look among her personal things.
I'm upstairs. They've got separate bedrooms, she says, walking into an airy room with dove blue wallpaper.
We can keep talking while you search. Tell me exactly what you're looking at.
The bed is made, and she's got a few books on the bedside table. Looks like psychology books.
Check the drawers.
Margot opens the two drawers in the bedside table and tells him that there are no documents there.
They're practically empty. A pack of Mogadon, throat sweets, and hand cream, she says.
Ordinary hand cream?
Clarins.
She puts her hand in the drawer and finds a little plastic tub.
A tub of dietary supplements? What sort?
Iron. Iron hydroxide.
Why do people take that?
Do you?
Yuna asks.
I eat enough meat for 5 people instead, Margot says, and closes the drawers.
Is there a wardrobe?
I'm on my way into her walk-in wardrobe, she says, walking in between the rows of clothes.
What's in there?
Dresses, skirts, suits, blouses. Don't think I'm envious, but it's all Burberry, Ralph Lauren, Prada.
She falls silent as she stares at one wall.
What's happening? Yuna asks.
Her shoes. I might have to have a little cry after all.
Carry on.
Yuna, I just want to say, I've done a lot of research. I've studied all the major cases of obsessive stalking, from John Hinckley to Mona Wallenhirpe, and no one comes anywhere close to the level of Nelly's fixation. She's the worst stalker ever.
I know.
Where do I look now?
Poke about at the back, Yuna replies. Look behind the shelves, under boxes. You need to find something.
They end the call, and Margot looks everywhere, leaning against the wall and crawling right to the back, but she finds absolutely nothing. Just as she walks back into the bedroom, she sees Roger Storm reach the top of the stairs. His face is sweaty, and he looks at her with his eyes wide open as he comes towards her. Margot sighs and presses her clenched hand against the small of her back to suppress the next contraction.
What is it?
She asks in a subdued voice.
We've received another film, he says.
Chapter 129. The sun has gone down, and Rocky has just woken up beside Yuna. The street lamps are coming on, and they are approaching Södertälje when Margot calls back.
We've received a new video, she says in an anguished voice. Presumably it's someone Eric knows or has at least described the film.
Nelly is already inside the victim's home when she begins filming. The woman seems injured,
She's sitting curled up in a corner. And at the end of the film, there's a small foot. It's dark, but it looks like there's a child lying on the floor.
Go on.
It's a perfectly ordinary, bloody room. Old walls and uneven wallpaper. There might be a big chimney outside the window, but forensics aren't done yet.
Go on.
I'm watching the video on an iPad right now. The woman has short black hair. She's thin and, I don't know, she's bleeding. She's almost unconscious and she's moving her hands as if she can't see anything or listen, Yuna interrupts. Her name is Jackie Federer, and she lives at Liliansplan. I'll send the rapid response unit, she says, and ends the call. Yuna doesn't have time to explain that she may well no longer be in her flat, because Nelly will want to kill Jackie in front of Eric's eyes, just as she killed her mother in front of her father, and Natalia in front of Rocky. They drive past a minibus parked at the side of the road with a puncture. A bearded man in shorts with sunburned legs is putting out a warning triangle.
You talked about a cage, about being locked in a cage, Yuna says to Rocky.
When was that?
Nelly had you locked up somewhere.
I don't think so, he replies, staring out at the road.
Do you know where that might have been?
No.
You escaped and stole a car near Nortelia.
I thought you were the one who goes around stealing cars, he mutters.
Think! It was a farm. There may have been a chimney.
Rocky sits there, watching the landscape flash by, and as they pass the junction for Salem, he lets out a deep sigh. He rubs his face and beard with his big hands, then looks back at the road again.
Nelly Brunt murdered Rebecca Hanson, he says slowly.
Yes.
God came back to look for me after all, he says, crumpling an empty cigarette packet.
It looks like it, Yuna replies gently.
Maybe I'll be punished for escaping and for having heroin in my pockets. But after that, I can go back to being a priest.
You've already been wrongly convicted. You won't be sentenced again, Yuna says.
Can you stop here? Rocky says calmly. I need to take a look at my church.
Yuna pulls over to the verge and lets him out. The big priest closes the car door, knocks on the roof, and then sets off in the direction of the turning for Salem. Chapter 130. When he was allocating work earlier that day, Ramon Schirlin, commanding officer of the Nortelia police, decided that Ule and George Brumann could take one of the patrol cars. They're father and son and don't often partner each other. Their colleagues joked that at last Ule, the father, would get a lesson in proper police work. Ule loves his colleagues' banter and is immensely proud of his son, who is a head taller than him. As usual, the day passed peacefully, and towards evening they drove out to Valby Industrial Estate, seeing as there had been several reports of break-ins there in the past 6 months. But everything was calm, and they didn't call in, and carried on towards Rimbu after a wee break. Ule's back is hurting, and he tilts the seat back a bit further, looks at the time, and is about to say they'll give it half an hour, then head back to the station, when a call from the Regional Communications Center comes in. SOS 112 received a phone call 30 minutes ago. A man called from a phone with very bad reception. The operator could barely hear anything, but analysis of the recording of the short conversation suggested that the man needed help and described a location involving a ruined factory somewhere in the vicinity of Rimbu. They had been able to identify the place as the house that had been built after the big fire at Sulbakken Glassworks.
"We're on our way back to the station," Ule mutters. "You haven't got time to take this first?" the operator asks.
"Okay, we'll take it," he replies.
Large drops of rain are falling on the roof of the car. Ule shivers and closes his window, managing to squash a brimstone butterfly.
"Suspected domestic down in Jemlinge," he tells his son.
George turns the car round and heads south, past large farms that open up the landscape in the middle of the black forests.
"Mum reckons you don't eat enough vegetables. She was going to make carrot lasagna," Ule says, "but I forgot to buy the carrots, so we're having beef patties instead."
"Sounds good,"
George grins. The fields are completely dark now. One wing of the butterfly falls down the inside of the window and drifts on the warm air from the vent. They stop talking when they turn off and start heading along the narrow track. The deep potholes make the suspension creak, and branches scrape the roof and sides of the car.
"For God's sake, this place is derelict," George says.
The car's headlights open up a tunnel through the darkness and make the swirling moths and the tall grass at the side of the track shine like brass.
"What's the difference between a cheese?"
Ule asks, absurdly.
"I don't know, Dad," George says, without taking his eyes off the track.
"There are holes in the cheese, but no cheese in the holes."
"Brilliant," his son sighs and drums his hands on the wheel. They turn into a large yard and see a huge chimney etched against the night sky. The tires roll slowly over crunching gravel. Ule leans closer to the windscreen, breathing through his nose.
"Dark,"
George mutters, turning the wheel. The headlights sweep across bushes and rusting machine parts when they are suddenly reflected back at them.
"A number plate,"
Ule says. They drive closer and see a car with its boot open parked in the yard among the ruins of the glassworks. The two men look towards the yellow house. It's surrounded by tall, stinging nettles, and the windows are black.
"Do you want to wait and see if they carry out a television?"
Ule asks quietly. George turns the wheel to the left and lines the car up so that the headlights are pointing straight at the veranda before putting the handbrake on.
"But the call was about a suspected domestic," he says, and opens his door.
"I'll go and take a look." "Not on your own,"
his dad says. The two police officers are wearing light protective vests under the jackets of their uniforms, and on their belts they're carrying their service pistols, extra magazines, batons, handcuffs, torches and radios. Their thin shadows stretch out over the ground, reaching all the way to the house across the nettles. George has pulled out his torch and suddenly imagines he's seen something move behind the broken glass of the ruins.
"What is it?"
Ule asks.
"Nothing,"
George replies with a dry mouth. The leaves rustle in the darkness, and then they hear a strange noise, like someone crying out in anguish from within the forest.
"Bloody deer, scaring people like that,"
Ule says. George shines his torch at a deep shaft between some collapsed brick walls. There are fragments of glass scattered among the weeds.
"What is this place?"
George whispers.
"Just stick to the path."
The flat disc of the torch moves over the dirty windows of the house. The glass is so filthy that it reflects no more than a grey shimmer. They wade through the tall nettles, and George makes a joke about the garden being greener than his dad's. One pane in the veranda has been nailed over with plywood, and there's a rusty scythe leaning against the wall.
"The row was probably about whose turn it was to do the cleaning,"
Ule says quietly. Chapter 131. Through the mesh of his cage, Eric watches as Jackie takes a cautious step backwards. She's frightened and confused, trying to grasp the situation without succumbing to panic. Nelly must have had her locked up somewhere in the house before she forced her down the stairs. Eric doesn't know what Nelly is thinking of doing, but he can see her exultant fury as she stands and stares at Jackie with her chin jutting out. He daren't plead with her. Anything he says will only make her jealous. Thoughts chase through his head in an attempt to find something that could break through her wounded rage. Jackie makes a clicking sound with her tongue and takes a step forward. She walks straight into the beam from the torch and stops for a moment as she feels the slight warmth. Now Eric can see how badly injured she is. Dark blood shining on her temple, and there are bruises on her face and a tear in her bottom lip. Her shadow fills the whole wall. Off to one side, just in front of her, Nelly wipes the sweat from her right hand onto her dress and picks up the knife from the table. Jackie hears the movement and backs up until she reaches the brick wall. Eric sees her run her hand across it, feeling for any deviations with her fingers. Something to help her orientate herself. "What have I done?" Jackie asks in a frightened voice. Eric looks down, waits a few seconds, then looks at Nelly instead. But she has already noticed him looking at Jackie. Her mouth is so tense that the sinews in her neck are visible. She wipes the tears from her cheeks, and the knife twitches in her right hand as she approaches Jackie. Eric sees that Jackie can sense Nelly's presence. She doesn't want to show how afraid she is, but the movement of her chest betrays the shallowness of her breathing. He can see that she instinctively wants to duck down, but is forcing herself to stand up straight. Nelly moves slowly sideways, and grit crunches beneath her shoes. Jackie tilts her head slightly towards the sound. Blood has congealed across her ear, temple, and cheek. Nelly holds the knife out towards Jackie and looks at her through narrow eyes. The point of the blade moves in front of the blind face, and a weak reflection trembles on the ceiling. Jackie raises her hand and the knife glides out of the way, but returns at once and slowly lifts the collar of her blouse. "Nelly, she's blind," Eric says, struggling to remain calm. "I don't see the point." Nelly jabs the point of the knife between her breasts. Jackie whimpers and touches the superficial injury with one hand. Her fingertips get covered with blood, and an expression of unadorned fear and confusion fills her pale face. "Look at her now," Nelly says. "Look at her! Look!" Jackie feels along the wall with her fingertips, walks straight into the table and almost falls, stumbling over a brick and taking a long stride to stop herself going down. "Very elegant," Nelly giggles and brushes the bloody hair from her face. Jackie backs away, and Eric hears her breathing like a wounded animal's. Nelly circles round her, and she moves to face the sound, holding her hands up the whole time to protect herself and trying to get her bearings in the room. She walks into the table again, and Nelly creeps behind her and jabs the knife into her back. Eric forces himself not to scream. Jackie groans with pain, takes a step forward, stumbles, and hits one knee on the floor. She gets up quickly as blood runs down her clothes, down one leg, and takes a few fumbling steps with her hands in front of her. "Eric, why are you doing this?" Jackie asks in a tremulous voice.
"Why are you doing this?"
Nelly mocks. "Eric?" she gasps, turning round.
"It's over between us," Eric says harshly. "Don't imagine that..."
"Don't talk to her!" Nelly shrieks at him.
"I don't give a shit about anything now. I'm not going to let the two of you..."
"Nelly,
I only want to be with you, no one else, Eric interrupts. I only want to look at you, at your face, and...
Do you hear that?
Nelly screams at Jackie.
What's wrong with you? He doesn't want some fucking blind bitch. Got that? He doesn't want you.
Jackie says nothing. She just sinks to her knees, shielding her face and head with her arms and hands. Nelly, that's enough now, Eric says, no longer able to keep his voice steady. She understands. She's no threat to us. She... Get up! He says that's enough. He wants to look at you. Show your face, your pretty little face. Nelly, please, get up!
Jackie slowly gets to her feet, and Nelly lunges with full force, but the blade misses her neck. The knife slides over her shoulder, right next to her throat. Jackie screams and falls backwards. Nelly jabs again, but hits nothing but thin air. She catches the blade on a shelf on the wall, and some tins of food topple over and fall to the floor.
Nelly, stop it! You've got to stop!
Eric cries, tearing at the mesh. Jackie shoves her with both hands, and Nelly staggers backwards, falls across the wooden sticks, and drops the knife.
Bray a fool in a mortar among wheat with a pestle.
Nelly whimpers in a high voice as she sweeps her hands across the floor. She grabs hold of one of the tins, gets to her feet, and hits Jackie with it, hard in her stomach, left breast, and collarbone. Jackie screams and manages to knock the tin from Nelly's hand, rolls over onto her side, and tries to get to her feet. Gasping, Nelly looks around at the dark shadows in the room and finds her knife on the floor by the wall.
Now I'm going to take her face,
Nelly mutters in a voice that sounds like she's got a mouth full of saliva. Jackie is on her knees with her face unprotected. Blood pours down her back. She's found a small screwdriver and gets unsteadily to her feet, panting for air. Nelly wipes the sweat from her eyes. Her green dress is smeared with dark stains. Jackie turns away from her and finds the stairs. Nelly smiles at Eric, then goes after Jackie. She raises the knife and stabs, but the blade misses and lands wrong, cutting a wound between Jackie's neck and shoulder. Jackie falls forward onto both knees, hits her forehead on the first step, and collapses. Nelly staggers back with the knife in her hand and blows the hair from her eyes when a bell suddenly rings. With the knife trembling in her hand, Nelly glares up at the stairs with a look of indecision on her face. The bell rings again, and she says something to herself, goes quickly past Jackie and up the stairs, then closes and locks the door behind her. Chapter 132. The two police officers wait on the veranda, but they can't hear anything. Just the wind in the trees and the chirruping of insects in the weeds.
What's the difference between a ham sandwich with gherkins and an old man with a cigarette in his arse?
Ule asks, ringing the bell again.
I don't know, George says.
Okay, I'll ask someone else to buy the sandwiches tomorrow.
Dad, really?
Ule laughs and shines his torch at the peeling door with its rusty handle. George knocks hard on the window next to them, then steps aside.
Let's go in,
Ule says, gesturing to his son to back away down the steps as he takes hold of the door handle. He's about to open it when a warm glow appears. The grey hall window suddenly looks welcoming. The door is opened by an elegant woman with a headscarf round her hair and a paraffin lamp in her hand. She's in the process of buttoning a yellow raincoat over her chest and looks at the two police officers with bemused surprise.
God, I thought it was the electrician. We've got a power cut, she says. What's happened?
We received an emergency call from here,
Ule replies. What for? She says, looking at them.
Is everything okay? George asks.
Yes, I think so, she says anxiously. What sort of emergency?
The steps creak as George takes a step closer. The woman smells strongly of sweat, and there's a splash of something on her neck. Without knowing why, he turns round and shines the torch out into the darkness along the front of the house.
It was a man who called. Is there anyone else in the house?
Only Eric. Did he call you? My husband has Alzheimer's.
We'd like to talk to him,
Ule says. Can't you do that tomorrow? He's just had his donepezil. She raises her hand to brush the hair from her forehead. Her fingernails are black, as if she's been digging in the earth.
It won't take long,
Ule says, taking a step inside.
I'd rather you didn't, she says.
The two police officers look into the hall. The wallpaper is brown, and a homemade rag rug covers the worn linoleum floor. On the wall is a framed biblical quotation, and a few outdoor clothes are hanging neatly on hangers. George watches his father go into the hall, shivers, and glances back at the car. Insects have been drawn to the strong headlights and are swirling like captives in their beam.
I'm afraid we're going to have to speak to your husband,
Ule says. Do we have to? His son asks quietly.
We received an emergency call, Ule tells the woman. I'm sorry, but this is how it works. We have to come in.
It won't take long, George says. They wipe their shoes carefully on the doormat. A curl of flypaper hangs in the same corner of the hall as the ceiling light. There are hundreds of flies covering the sticky paper like black fur.
Can you just hold this? The woman says, passing the paraffin lamp to Ule.
The light from the lamp flickers across the walls. George waits behind his dad as the woman pushes the door to the dark kitchen open with both hands. A creak of metal echoes through the hall. George hears her talking about her husband's illness as she walks into the darkness of the kitchen. The stench emerging through the open door hits them. Ule coughs and follows the woman, holding the lamp in his hand. The yellow light plays over the chaos in the kitchen. There's broken glass, saucepans, and old tools everywhere. The filthy floor is smeared with fresh blood, and the drips are splattered high up the cupboard doors. Ule turns back to his son, who's right behind him, when the door suddenly shuts with immense force. It hits George square in the face, and he's thrown backwards, hitting his head on the hall floor. Ule simply stares at the door, sees the huge spring, then looks at his son's foot sticking out between the door and the post. When he turns round, the woman is holding a long-handled axe over her shoulder, and before he has time to move, she strikes. The blade enters his neck from above and off to the side. The blow sends him reeling sideways, and he sees his own blood spatter the woman's raincoat. He gets jerked off balance as she pulls the axe free and takes a step forward to stop himself falling. She calmly takes the paraffin lamp from his hand and sets it on the worktop before lifting the heavy axe over her shoulder again. Ule wants to shout to his son, but he has no voice. He's on the point of losing consciousness. Black clouds are billowing up in his field of vision. He puts one hand to his neck and feels blood running down inside his shirt as he tries to draw his pistol, but there's no strength left in his fingers. The woman strikes again, and everything goes black. Out in the hall, George opens his eyes and looks around. He's lying on his back, and his forehead is bleeding. "What the hell just happened?" he gasps.
He feels his nose and bleeding forehead with trembling hands. "Dad," he says, noticing that his foot is stuck in the door. His ankle feels broken, but strangely enough, it doesn't hurt. He pulls and realizes he hasn't got any feeling in his toes. Confused, he looks up at the ceiling and sees the spiral of flypaper swaying above him. He hears thuds from inside the kitchen and pushes himself up onto his elbows, but can't see anything through the crack in the door. He fumbles and manages to pull his torch from his belt and points it into the kitchen. His dad is lying on the floor with his mouth open, staring at him. Suddenly, his head rolls over a few times when the woman shoves it aside with her foot. It rolls and spins on the bloody linoleum floor. George is seized by utter panic, lets out a loud scream, drops the torch and tries to move backwards, kicking at the door with his free foot. But it's like he's caught in a man-trap. He fumbles for his pistol but can't manage to pull it out. He needs to take his glove off first and puts his hand to his mouth to use his teeth when the door suddenly opens and he's free. Panting, he shuffles backwards and hits his back against a small desk, and a bowl of coins falls to the floor, scattering money around him. He manages to get his glove off and pulls his pistol from its holster as the woman in the yellow raincoat comes out into the hall. She raises the axe above her head, striking the lamp and bringing the coil of flypaper down. The heavy blade hits his chest with terrible force, cutting straight through the thin protective vest and his rib cage, down into his heart. Chapter 133. Eric stretches out through the mesh of the cage to reach Jackie, but she's too far away from him. His fingertips flail at the air behind her back. Without knowing if she can hear him, he keeps talking to her the whole time, saying she needs to get up and make her way out through the tunnel. Nellie has already been gone several minutes. At first he didn't even know if Jackie was alive. She just lay slumped on the floor without moving. But when he lay on the floor against the mesh of the cage, he could hear her breathing. "Jackie," he says again. He knows she'd be dead now if the doorbell hadn't rung. In spite of the silence, he knows it's the police. It must be the police. They did hear his phone call. As long as they realize how serious it is, he thinks. As long as they've sent enough officers. He picks the stick up from the ground, reaches out with it, and gently pokes Jackie with the blunt end. "Jackie?" She slowly moves one leg, turns her face and coughs weakly. Once again, Eric explains what's happened, what Nellie has done, how he got the blame, but that Una knows the truth. She lifts one hand, tiredly, to the superficial wound on her neck. Eric has no idea how much she understands of what he's saying, but he repeats that she needs to get away, that she needs to hurry. "You need to fight now. You won't survive otherwise," he says. She doesn't have long. He's been listening for pistol shots, for voices, but can't hear anything. "Jackie, try to stand up now," he pleads. Finally, she sits up. Blood is running from her eyebrow, down over her cheek, and she's gasping for breath. "Can you hear me?" he says again. "Do you understand what I'm saying? You need to run, Jackie. Can you stand up?" He says nothing about calling the police, doesn't want to give her false hope. She needs to get away because he doesn't trust the police not to fall for Nellie's lies. Jackie stands up, groans, and spits blood on the floor. She lurches forward but stays on her feet. "You need to get away from here before she comes back," he repeats. Jackie stumbles towards his voice, breathing heavily with her arms outstretched. "Go in the other direction," he says. You have to get out of the ruins and away across the fields. She makes her way carefully past the tins on the floor and reaches the cage with her hands. I'm locked in a cage, he says.
Everyone's saying you killed four women, she whispers.
It was Nelly. You don't have to believe me as long as you get away from here.
I knew you didn't do it, she says.
He strokes the fingers clinging to the cage. She leans forward and rests her forehead on the rusty metal. You've got to keep going a bit longer, he says, stroking her cheek. Turn round so that I can take a look. You've been wounded. Jackie, you're not seriously hurt, but you do need to get to a hospital. Hurry up and Maddie's still at home, she whimpers. Thank God she was hiding in her wardrobe when she'll be fine, Eric says. She'll be fine.
I don't understand any of this, Jackie whispers, and her face crumples with anxiety.
How does it feel when you breathe? Eric asks. Try to cough. You'll be okay. Your pleural cavity is probably damaged, but you were lucky, Jackie. Listen, there's a little torch on the table. You can feel its warmth. You'll know where it is.
She wipes her mouth, nods, and tries to pull herself together. Can you fetch it?
There's nothing between you and... He breaks off when he hears a loud thud from upstairs. It's the kitchen door slamming shut thanks to the powerful spring.
What was that? She whispers, her lips quivering.
Hurry up. You can walk straight towards the torch. There's nothing on the floor between you and the table. She turns and walks towards the tiny source of heat, feels across the table, picks up the torch, and returns to Eric with it.
Do you know where the opening to the tunnel is? He asks.
More or less, she whispers. It's fairly narrow. It's a small brick opening, no door, he explains as he hears someone scream up above.
You need to run away. Get as far away as you possibly can. Take this stick. You can use it to feel your way.
She looks as if she's about to break down. Her face is drained of color, her lips already white with the shock to her circulation.
Eric, it won't work. Nelly will kill you when she comes back.
Listen, there's a passageway. I don't know what it looks like further along. It could be blocked, but you have to try to get out. The whole area is surrounded by ruins, and you'll be able to...
I can't, she whimpers, twisting her head back and forth in an anxious, repetitive pattern. Please, just listen to me. When you reach the cellar with no ceiling, you'll have to climb up to reach ground level.
What are you going to do? She whispers.
I can't get out. Nellie's got the key round her neck.
But how am I going to find my way?
In the darkness, the blind man is king, he says simply.
Her face trembles as she turns round and starts to walk, feeling the ground in front of her with the stick. He holds the torch up and tries to guide her. The angled light makes the shadows stretch and shrink.
There's a load of roof tiles on the floor ahead of you, he says. Move a little to your right, and you'll be heading straight for the opening.
Then the pair of them hear the bar being lifted from the cellar door as it jolts and scrapes back against the wall.
Hold your hand out now, Eric whispers. You'll be able to feel the wall on your left. Just follow that.
Jackie walks into something that clatters. A tin of paint rolls away, and Eric sees her shrink with fear.
Don't stop, he hisses. You have to get home to Maddie.
The door above them opens, closes, and clicks. But there's no sound of footsteps on the stairs. Jackie has reached the opening now, and Eric watches her carry on into the passage, holding one hand against the wall and sweeping the ground ahead of her with the stick. Eric points the torch at the floor and sees Nelly come down the stairs and step out into the middle of the cellar. Her yellow oilskin is smeared with blood, and she's clutching a smaller kitchen knife in her hand. Her eyes are staring straight at him. He doesn't know how much she has time to see before he switches the torch off. Everything goes completely dark, as if someone had swept the whole world away from them. "Nelly, they'll send more police officers," he says, holding his injured arm with his hand. "Do you understand? It's over now."
"It's never over,"
she replies, and stands quite still, a meter or so away from him, just breathing. There's a clattering sound from the tunnel. Nelly giggles and walks across the floor. Eric hears her hit the stack of tiles, go round them, and carry on through the darkness towards the tunnel. Chapter 134. Jackie is heading along a narrow passageway as fast as she can. Her right hand is feeling its way along the wall, and she's moving the stick to and fro in front of her. She needs to get as far away as she can, try to find a way out, and then keep going until she finds help. Fear is washing over her. It's almost like being burned, and she manages to kick a bottle lying on the floor that she missed with her stick. It tinkles as it rolls away across the rough floor. Her fingertips slip across the bricks and crumbling mortar. She notes that she's passing a seventh vertical indentation in the wall. She keeps count automatically because it makes things easier if she has to find her way back. Jackie is having difficulty breathing. The pain in her back flares up like a beacon with every step she takes. Warm blood is still trickling from the wound, down between her buttocks and along her legs. She isn't sure if Eric was telling the truth when he said she wasn't seriously hurt, or if he was only trying to calm her down so that she would dare to escape. She coughs and feels a cramping pain from her injured lung just below her shoulder blade. Her stick isn't quite quick enough. Her shin hits some sort of apparatus with sharp tin corners and dangling cables. She has to clamber over the machine, and her legs are trembling with effort and fear. She has no way of knowing how long the passageway is, but she has a feeling that she's inside a system of tunnels and cellars. She's walking a little too fast the whole time and knows there's a serious risk that she's going to trip over. She passes a room on her left. It's there as a gap in the acoustics. Jackie decided to stop counting the indentations. She needs to concentrate on finding a way out.
"Nelly's coming," Eric calls from the basement room behind her. "She's on her way now."
His voice sounds frightened, weakened by the long tunnel, but she hears him and understands his warning. Nellie's coming after her. Jackie tries to move faster, makes her way round an armchair and carries on along the wall, her fingers brushing a number of shelves. Something rattles behind her and she almost cries out in fear. It's getting harder and harder to breathe. Jackie holds her hand over her mouth and tries to cough quietly as she presses ahead. Mid-stride, her face hits something, an open cupboard door. It slams shut, and there's a tinkling sound of glass objects rattling on shelves. Memories of the violence she has been subjected to flash past. The feeling of a sharp knife blade being yanked out with a sigh, and the constricting pain in her back. Her breathlessness feels like a weight. She knows she's breathing too hard, but it still doesn't feel like she's getting enough oxygen. She moves the stick quickly and lets the other hand brush over bricks and joints, past a thick cable, along bare brick again, then some old window frames that are stacked against the wall. She's trying to read the space the whole time. Whenever she hears an opening, she stops for a few seconds and listens to check if it's another passageway or just an enclosed room. She keeps moving along the main passageway, seeing as the weak draft across the floor seems to be coming from up ahead. A protruding bolt tears the skin of her knuckles, and now she can hear her pursuer behind her. Nelly shouts something to her, but Jackie can't make out the words. The voice makes panic bubble up inside her, and the hand holding the stick is sweating. She trips over a brick, loses her balance, and starts to fall. She throws her arm out, puts her hand through some thick spider's webs, and hits the wall hard. Her back shrieks with pain, cutting through her like a javelin with the sudden contortion, and she can taste blood in her mouth. A crash from the tunnel behind her makes her ears ring. It sounded like the cupboard full of glass objects falling over. She hears a load of glass break, shattering and scattering across the floor. Jackie wipes her sweaty hand on her legs, takes a firm grip of the stick, and carries on as fast as she can. The fingertips of her right hand have gone numb from the rough brick wall. She can hear footsteps behind her, much faster than her own. Jackie turns into a side passage in panic. Her heart is pounding. "This isn't going to work," she thinks. "Nelly knows her way around these tunnels. This is her territory." Jackie forces herself to go on. The passageway is narrower than the last one. She stumbles over some old fabric and feels something catch round her foot and drag along behind her. "Jackie!" Nelly shouts. "Jackie!" She tries not to cough, feels herself pass a hole in the wall fairly close to the roof, and hears air streaming through it as something grabs at her clothes. It's holding onto her blouse, pulling her backwards. She flails her arms in panic and hears the fabric tear. She's stuck and is trying to pull free when she hears Nelly once more. She must have followed her into the side passage. Jackie pulls at her blouse and turns round, puts her hand under her left arm and feels a thick pipe. She's walked into a pipe that's somehow hanging from the roof. It's got caught in her clothes, and she has to back up several meters to free herself. Nelly is close now. Mortar is crunching under her boots, and her clothes rustle as she moves. Breathing through her nose, Jackie carries on along the passageway. Then she hears Nelly let out a whimper. She, too, has walked into the dangling pipe. A metallic clang echoes off the walls. Jackie hurries on and emerges into a large room with a slower echo. There's a smell of stagnant water in the air, like an old aquarium. Jackie keeps moving and almost immediately bumps into something and drops her stick. She's breathing far too quickly. She bends over and feels a large trough filled with dusty soil, twigs, and pieces of bark. The pain in her back almost makes her topple forwards, but she goes on searching beside the trough, feeling tentatively across old bottles, spiders' webs, and twigs. She hears Nelly call out to her. She's nearer again. Jackie gives up looking for the stick. She'll have to go on without it. With her arms outstretched, she feels her way past a series of alcoves with brick walls dividing them. She stops in front of a large object that's blocking the whole room. It's a long steel washbasin. She feels along it to one end and has just made her way round it when she hears Nelly's footsteps behind her. Jackie clicks her tongue loudly the way she has learned to. The room around her reflects the sound as vague echoes that her brain turns into a three-dimensional map. She clicks again, but is far too scared for it to work well. She doesn't have time to listen properly, can't get any real sense of the room. Panting for breath, she moves on. Her whole body is shaking and she doesn't know how to stop it. She turns her head and clicks again, and suddenly becomes aware of an opening off to her left. Jackie reaches the wall with her hands, follows it until she finds the opening, and once again feels the coolness of air from outside. It's a narrow passageway, its floor covered with loose grit and what smells like the charred remains of wood and plastic. One foot treads straight through a window pane lying on the ground, and it shatters with a loud crash. She knows she's cut her foot, but stumbles on across the floor. As she reaches out to the wall, her fingers dislodge crumbs of dry mortar, and then she hears Nelly stand on the glass. She's right behind her. Jackie breaks into a run with one hand against the wall and the other stretched out in front of her. She runs into a wooden trestle and falls over it, lands on her left shoulder and groans with pain. She tries to crawl, but something hits the floor right beside her. It sounds like a plastic pipe or a broom handle. Jackie crawls forward and hits her head on the wall. She manages to get up onto her feet again, stumbles across some fallen bricks, and leans against the wall. Chapter 135. Jackie isn't entirely sure of the direction of the passageway. She turns and follows the wall backwards for a meter or so, listens, but can no longer hear Nelly. Her own breathing is so labored that she has to hold one hand over her mouth in an effort to stay quiet. Something rustles in front of her, down on the floor, moving slowly. It's only a rat. Jackie stands completely still, breathing through her nose. She has no idea how to find her way out. Terror is preventing her from thinking. She's too stressed to be able to interpret her surroundings correctly. A short distance away from her, something creaks. It sounds like a heavy door or even an old mangle. She desperately wants to hide, curl up on the floor with her arms over her head, but she forces herself to go on. Her feet crunch on stones, charred pieces of wood, and drifts of sand and grit. The walls have collapsed in places, completely blocking the corridor, and she has to clamber over the heaps. Stones roll down the slope behind her, and fragments of glass break into smaller pieces. Jackie hears air rushing through a small gap higher up, and keeps crawling, leaning on her hands. A broken plank scrapes her thigh, and her feet slide across bricks and mortar. There's a rustling sound behind her, and she climbs.